Welcome to my Bob Thurman podcast. I'm so grateful some good friends enabled me to present them to you. If you enjoy them and find them useful, please think of becoming a member of Tibet House US to help preserve Tibetan culture. Tibet House is the Dalai Lama's cultural center in America. All best wishes. Have a great day.
This podcast extra was originally recorded at the Artist and Buddhist Contemplatives Retreat at Garrison Institute, used with permission.
I mentioned to Meredith that exercise we did with her. We were all reciting the shortest Prajnaparamita Sutra. Everyone thinks the Heart Sutra is the shortest sutra, but actually, the shortest sutra is one syllable, and it is the syllable "ah." And of course, like everything about enlightenment, has a double meaning, because in the first sense, "ah" is a negation. Like in English or in Greek, you know, we have like amoral, aniconic, you know, whatever it is, you know, atheist. That's a atheist. So it's a negation, which is shunyata, emptiness is a negation. A negation of intrinsic reality of anything. A non-relational element in anything. It negates. So is the negation of all relational things that we wrongly perceive as having some absolute essence. And thereby actually releasing the relativity of the things. And the second side of it, the "ah," is considered the creative sound. It's the Brahma sound. And in the Indian cosmos, when there are periods of dissolution or pralaya, between big bangs and big crunches. After the big crunch, there's a period of dissolution and in the cycles of different universes. And but unlike us, they don't think that what are lying around in this dissolution period are some sort of molecules or atoms or particles that have no home. What they are letters, consonants that have no sound, so they are inarticulate. So they're uncreated, sort of, they're just lying around. And then the Brahma sound, the creator sound, is "ah." And then the "ah" comes and picks up all the letters, and then the poetry of the universe ensues in the Indian idea. Language is like, you know, like this, like in John, the Gospel of John, remember, in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was, etc. You know, they have that idea. Westerners have that idea, too. So we were reciting the Prajnaparamita Sutra the easy way. Ah. That's the first thing. Second thing, before I start this sort of sequential thing, somehow sitting with you and thinking about it all, and in being in the privileged state of nearly somewhat deaf, with my batteries of my hearing aids not working well, I was thrown back on thought to some extent. And I was thinking about nirvana. Because nirvana, in the non-dual Buddhist teaching, Buddha's non-dual teaching, which we might call Mahayana, or, and sort of esoterically, you could say also Theravada too, which may ultimately be non-dual, though it seems to be dual. It seems to be dual. It's meant to seem to be dual to those who would be misled by non-duality too soon. But anyway, in that teaching, the Buddha discovered nirvana, the third noble truth, and one of its names is the uncreated, the profound, the peaceful, the luminous, the uncomplicated. When he, in the Sanskrit version of the Buddha's first statement upon enlightenment, that's what he said. Profound, peaceful, luminous, uncomplicated, and uncreated. And he didn't, well, he said, like an elixir of immortality is this reality that I have discovered. So, along with all of that, he found it very juicy, very delicious. And he knew it with bliss. He explains later, much later, that he understood it with the subjectivity of bliss itself as a subjectivity, as a way of knowing. As a way of knowing that they say in Prajnaparamita type literature, as knowing by the way of not knowing, meaning non-dualistically knowing, meaning knowing via bliss through subject melting into object, or object melting into subject, whatever, subject-object melting into non-difference. So I was thinking about how we, by that definition, the artist, everyone actually, but of course especially the artist, is already in nirvana. If there is any such thing as nirvana, if Buddha was not kidding with the third noble truth of the cessation of suffering, which is the minimalist way of expressing it, or the bliss void indivisible, which might be a maximalist way of expressing it. If he meant anything by it, it's a condition we've always been in already, beginninglessly and endlessly, because it's uncreated. It's not a causal product. It cannot be entered, except in a manner of speaking, because if you entered it, it would have an entrance. If it had an entrance, it would have some place outside it. If it was relational in that way, it would not be ultimate reality or absolute reality. So in some sense, it cannot be relational in that way. So it has to be here, now, all of us. And we can only discern it through bliss. And enlightenment in that way then is defined as when the bliss is total, infinite, unending, and experienced also as unbeginning, as always having been there. When the merger is with all of time as well as all of space. And time and space are dimensions that are seen as illusory, not utterly non-existent, but illusory. Actually, everything still remains existent, actually. Having always been immersed in this non-dual, nirvanic uncreatedness, nothing is damaged, but the quality of its relativity, of its relationality, is forever changed. And that's when one becomes a Buddha. One then fully has the full bliss of the full experience, the endless, infinite, beginningless experience of nirvana. So the artist, therefore, when one is not yet in nirvana, one discerns oneself as a separated entity, inside one's skin, inside one's senses, inside one's spirit, as separate from others, from the volume of the universe, from the past and future points of time, imagined areas of time. One imagines, and therefore one is sort of clawing one's way along within some sort of an other, and finding that difficult, actually, and finding that situation overwhelming. This vast other, which is so much greater than the self, however defined, however identified, it's just too much to be confronted with this vast other, and hence the truth of suffering, where even temporary relief, temporary somehow pleasure, is called the suffering of change. However, even such a person as myself, for example, in that state, perhaps some of us, sometimes have a kind of bliss feeling that doesn't seem dependent upon an object. Somehow we become aware of a kind of inner bliss. In fact, logically we can understand that what holds the molecules in our body, the cells, what holds our health, our pulse, if you will, our organs, you know, our tissues, what holds it together is that it all wants to be together. It wants to merge with the next cell, at least. It allows itself merger with the next cell, the next piece of tissue, through bliss. So somehow, for example, our sense of health or vitality or vigor is bliss. And whatever bliss there is that is not objectified, that is not sort of pegged, oh, I'm blissful because I just heard something or I did something or I got something or whatever it is, but it's just a bliss that wells up somehow, inexplicably. It a little bit wipes us out, actually, from our sense of self-identity, separateness, and so on. And whatever of that bliss that we feel, that is touching the nirvanic hole that we're actually always in. It is like, it is the presence, infinite presence of nirvana, beginningless, you know, inextinguishable presence of nirvana, the fact that this relationality, whether it's a relationality of samsara or of a mandalic Buddha land or something, a pure land, whatever the relationality is, the illusory, magical, matrix-like relationality, its substance is this clear light of the void, actually, something like that, is this nirvanic plenum. Because nirvana, like space, it doesn't get in the way of the object that occupies it. Nirvana itself is empty of itself. It's not has no intrinsic reality apart from anything. In a way, it is the reality of all of this, but it when looked at as a separate thing, it itself dissolves under analysis when approached in that way. So therefore, the artist is a person, whether poet or painter or architect or engineer or whatever, is a being and a person who somehow is less enchanted with like being productive, being rich, being famous, being this, being that, somehow fortifying the essentially unviable condition of being a separate entity crawling through this vast other, and therefore somehow feels this kind of unexpected blisses welling up from their fingertips or their belly or their backbone or their toes, whatever, forehead. And so that artist has that feeling that maybe what lurks behind the matrix that lurks behind the seemingly disparate forms is bliss, actually, rather than nothing, or rather than some dangerous, unpredictable entity that's up to no good. Church lady's favorite Satan, or in various people's idea of some person, some God person, who is withholding somehow some state of beatitude from us. Instead of that, maybe there's just pure bliss there. The artist senses that. It kind of drives them a little crazy, I think. So then their motivation, but it drives them a little crazy, but it also gives them a sense of well-being that seems unfounded, unreasonable, but nevertheless is there to either drive them or calm them, depending on how they are oriented. Hold them. Buddha redefined the word dharma from how it had been understood in India before his time, although in fact it was rarely used in the Vedic literature. But it was used there to mean law, pattern, custom, duty. You know, your dharma is to be a warrior, Arjuna, you have to fight, etc., this kind of thing. Dharma had that kind of meaning, pattern-maintaining meaning, before Buddha's time. And Buddha changed the meaning, or he knew those meanings were there, but he added transvalued meaning, and he said that the dhara of dharma, that which means to hold, is that dharma as reality holds beings in freedom from suffering. That dharma is, in reality, nirvana, the cessation of suffering. And so it's that we are held in that nirvana. In fact, by dharma, although we are all too unaware of it, too much of our lifetimes, many lifetimes. But the artist is the one who is more aware of it, without Buddhism. Doesn't mean there has to be a Buddhist, by the way. You know, Van Gogh or something, maybe they heard of Buddha, this kind of thing, but they have that, they feel it in reality, because Buddhism is just realism. It's the teaching of someone who encountered reality fully, who realized reality in his own being, in every other being as well. So the artist's motivation is love and compassion, of course. Because when you feel bliss, what is the automatic thing that you want to do with your bliss? When you feel it, or what does bliss want to do with you? Let's say, you know, it wants to share itself. It experiences anything that is walling off bliss as mistaken, as unnecessarily self-deprived. And so it's automatic. But problem with it is, problem it discovers, the artist discovers, is that the artist cannot simply bomb the unblissful with bliss. The unblissful feeling the assault of an energy, whatever it may be, will resist and will tighten more, like trying to hug a paranoiac. You're giving a big hug, but the paranoiac is feeling assaulted and becoming more uptight, intensifying their emotional plague, in the immortal words of Wilhelm Reich. So then the artist has to be artful. The artist is forced to find a way around the wall of defense within which the unenlightened being, the being who intensifies their separateness from everything because they fear that everything might contain a germ, it might contain a sharp point, it might contain something terrible, you know, frightful. And so the artful one has to work around it and somehow inspire the closed one to imagine being open, to imagine the safety of being open, imagine the benevolence of the world around it, come up with what psychologist Erik Erikson once called basic trust of the universe, the very first part of developing a sane personality in his view. So the artist has to somehow work its way in, her or his, its way in. Through, and of course the only way in that there is to another being is through that being's understanding, through that being's own realization. So that's why they say that the greatest gift is not the gift of material things and is not the gift of security and protection, but is the gift of teaching, actually. Because it is teaching that can help another open to understanding something more about reality. And the more one understands about reality, one understands that reality is bliss and ignorance is suffering. Ignorance of that reality is suffering. And wisdom and insight into that reality is bliss. One time His Holiness at Emory University, the Dalai Lama at Emory University, was on a panel with Richard and Alice Walker to talk about art. And they, of course, with deference and affection and respect, turned to him at the beginning of this panel in a large auditorium with a lot of many Emory students and faculty and people from the city of Atlanta. And they said, "Your Holiness, what do you like to tell us about art?" So His Holiness did one of his typical super honest things, and he said, "You're the artist. I don't know anything about art. I have nothing to say. You tell everybody." And everybody liked those things like, "Oh my God, you know, what happened? There's no point being here, whatever." So then they tried to make the best of it, started to talk and so on, and then of course they got a lively conversation going. And so on, but His Holiness had in his mind that art is a painting, or art is a sculpture, or a book, or a poem, you know. He thought that's what art was. It was translated to him like that, like la diva, diva, you know, diatic, you know, rimotic, you know. Then later I met him, I had an excuse to meet him briefly about some work, and I lost my purpose of my short visit, because I couldn't stand it. I said, "Your Holiness, of course you know everything about art. Don't listen to some translators who tell you that art is just some artifact. Art is the seventh paramita in the 10 paramita system." He says, "What do you mean?" I says, "Well, the sixth paramita is wisdom. And when one has prajna paramita, the sixth paramita, the wisdom paramita, it means one has at least some deep knowledge of reality. Once you have a deep knowledge of reality, you feel relief, joy, bliss, to some degree, depending on how deep it was. And then the seventh paramita is the paramita of art, of how the compassion that automatically flows from the bliss of realizing the nature of reality and that that reality is bliss, is blissful. Reality wants to give itself to you as pure bliss rather than be feared like an angry god or like a silly nothingness, or at least a peaceful, quiet, and aesthetic nothingness, but still nothing, nothing much, no big deal, no rush. And instead of any of those things, it wants to give itself to you in bliss. The minute you feel that through wisdom, you then... your compassion becomes upaya. And upaya doesn't mean skillful means or means. There's no word skill, actually. The skill is kaushalya. They do use upaya with a word called kaushalya, which means skill. But upaya by itself just means a method or means. That's not wrong. But what it really means is the kind of method of conveying reality to someone who needs to know more of reality and become more free of unreality, because they're suffering in unreality, and the more they open to reality, the less they suffer, and the better they feel. So upaya is therefore artfulness. It's art in itself. And it includes all things that bodhisattvas, then they learn to paint, they sing, they sculpt, they play music, they do the art of curing, healing. Medicine is not science, and medicine is art. There's research, scientific preparation for medicine, but the actual work of healing is art of healing. In arts and sciences, engineering is art. It's building things that help beings. So, of course, I was considerably shorter in telling His Holiness. And so he got it. He got it totally. He said, right. He said, the bodhisattva, when they know what is real, then their whole preoccupation becomes tap in Tibetan, method, but especially art, meaning eliciting in one who doesn't know reality an imagination of what reality can be, which helps them aim themselves toward experiencing that reality. And the artist is not thinking, oh, I'm doing some sort of didactic thing here. They're not thinking that. They're just automatically feeling bliss. Bliss becomes compassion, because you know, compassion without bliss, like, forget about it. Someone wants you to feel better. They feel so sorry for you, but they feel worse than you do. Then what is that going to do for you? I don't think so. No, no, no. I don't think that's going to help. But if they feel blissful, and then they see where you are blocking that bliss, and their compassion is helping you unblock. Because the more blissful you are, you see the potential bliss in the other, the beauty in them. Bliss is also the essence and source of beauty, of course. Most powerful energy. Clear light of the void is bliss. Anyway, so that's what I was thinking. So His Holiness really got it. He said, upaya paramita, right after prajna paramita, upaya, how to convey to a world that imagines all kinds of frightening things about everybody else, about their environment, about the planet, about the poor Western people. They look out in the night sky and they see this like hopeless bunch of supernova stars, hot, burning, totally unlivable, all of them. And here we are, this tiny little skin of atmosphere on this one little planet, and they tell us we're probably the only one, we're accident, and they have no purpose and meaning, and like it's about to be snuffed out by too much ozone or too much methane, or all those cow farts. Drew us in, and like we're all alone, and Carl Sagan's broadcasting the Beatles, hopefully, out there, and Ariel's hoping to pick up the Rolling Stones from Alpha Centauri. But no silence. But luckily, we'll all be nothing. We'll all revert to the nothing that we are, since we have no mind and soul and spirit, so we can somehow take this horribly gloomy vision of reality. Whereas, let's read the Flower Ornament Sutra, and you look, and there's Samantabhadra in every star, every atom. There's infinite planets of humans. It's like a vast mosaic, a Turkish carpet of different human realms, infinite numbers, infinite human beings, infinite enlightened bodhisattvas, infinite Buddhas in every atom, actually, and in every galaxy. It's a vision like that. It's a really cheery vision. Well, could be mass delusion, but it's much less. No one can be sure until they become a Buddha, but it's much less awful than our mass delusion, which is causing us to destroy the little planet that we think is the only one we do have. Within that, of course, the ultimate art would be yourself if you became a Buddha, which you will inevitably do. No one can evade that fate. I hate to say. Doesn't mean you have to be a Buddhist. You can be a Jain Buddha, you can be a Christian Buddha, you can be a secularist Buddha, whatever Buddha. It's hard to be a completely secularist Buddha, actually ignoring the second law of thermodynamics for your mind. But, you know, with the idea of the nothingness being the real thing, that's too irrational, really, you know, too awful, a trap. But, so not secular in any particular, in the sort of modern materialist, reductionist, scientistic way. But you can be any kind of Buddha. But Buddha just means that finally you realize you get tired of living in an unreality, in a environment that you don't know what it is. And you're sort of not sure what you're doing, and now you follow this rule or that leader or this idea, but you just don't really know what it is. And you get tired of it, and you decide you just want to face it, whatever it is, reality. The sixth bodhisattva stage achieved through the Prajnaparamita is called Abhimukhi. And Abhimukhi means superfacing, meaning that you just have to face reality. You have to look at it. You can't evade it. You can't look away from it. You look at it within, without, everywhere. And when you, with your fantastic, extraordinary human intelligence that you evolved over billions and trillions of lifetimes, as you were seeking infinitude, as you were seeking bliss, actually, infinite bliss, you sought the human form, which is like this more malleable, variable, wide open, incredibly intelligent form compared to a lion or a tiger or a snake or whatever kind of other animal that we've all been, according to Buddha's experience that he recounted to us. So when you become a Buddha anyway, then you're in this strange state of having merged with the clear light of the void. You went down through the eight levels that are detailed in the so-called Book of the Dead and in various other treatises of inner science. And you go down through dissolving this connection to the coarse body, a connection to the subtle neurological nervous system, the chakra system, and you go and you enter this sort of completely extraordinary space which you can only enter through the bliss of all your cells and molecules with your total body and mind. You cannot enter it just with your intellect. You cannot, but your intellect will guide you to it. Actually, you mustn't throw it away, ever. That is a mistake. But you cannot enter with that, but you can come to the brink. And then you enter it with your heart. Because your heart is already in it, you know, you have this what's called what the Buddha nature or indestructible drop, the super subtle body-mind, beyond physical mental duality, beyond the subatomic, beyond particles and waves. It's this clear light mind, bliss mind, that has no time, no space, but can permeate all of time and space. And you know, you can't describe it, so therefore they spend a lot of paper and language describing the vectors that bring you to approach to this something, since you can't describe it. Knowing that you can't describe it liberates you to describe it, describe the heck out of it. Because you're not trying to capture it, you know it's uncapturable. But anyway, when you do that, then you somehow, you identify with infinite, everything, and with every other being. So you have become everything, you've become one with everything, truly, but in a non-dual way, not one with everything as just in some blank space, some emptiness that's the reality of everything. No way, because that reality is empty of itself, and it is all the disparate things. So you're one with everything in all of its disparateness. You're one with every being, yet they're allowed to still be themselves. And yet you feel one with them without swallowing them or mushing them up in your merger. And therefore you see them all as made of bliss and yourself as made of bliss. But then the one frustrating thing is you're fully aware exactly how they don't see themselves full of bliss. They ruin their own health by not appreciating that their health is their bliss, etc. And so, you want to do what they say Avalokiteshvara does, you know, who is His Holiness Karmapa, His Holiness Dalai Lama, millions of Taras, millions of Avalokiteshvaras who don't have official position, millions of them, the countless numbers. And you say, you gangla gangdul dela detamba, you manifest whatever educates whomsoever, whatever liberates, whatever tames whomsoever they have. You can translate dulwa many ways. Gangla gangdul dela detamba. So you yourself become a work of art. And sometimes that being who is there struggling, they need to talk to a parrot. Sometimes they need to pet a dog. Sometimes they need a new island. They need a house. They need a mirror. They need either animate object, inanimate object. They need a person to talk to, a shoulder to cry on, a person to love, a person who loves them. You're ready to manifest infinite numbers of such beings. And you have that in that. You know that infinite bliss energy is there to draw on, to manifest. The matière that you're drawing on is the matière of bliss, which can be a material, it can be verbal, it can be spiritual, it can be magical, whatever is needed, you can do it. This is the extravagant vision that the Buddhists have of called the Nirmanakaya, the emanation body. It's like Neo in the Matrix. Why I love that film so much, because once he knew he was the one, meaning that he knew he was the entirety of the program, as well as an individuated or any number of individuated entities within it, so he could reshape them, he could interact with what others felt were the solid, stable, immovable objects in the matrix, but he could completely move around them to try to avoid harm and to create good. He was like the Samantabhadra of the Matrix. Okay. Oh yeah, there's you might show yourself as that when you become a Buddha. Vajrasattva. Vajrasattva who holds the scepter of great bliss. Great bliss as compassion, or compassion as universal compassion, great bliss in his right hand. And he holds the bell of infinite wisdom in his left hand. And that infinite wisdom being clear light of the void. And that bliss is the male, and the bell, clear light of the void, infinite wisdom is the female. And he holds the male and female elements in himself and in the universe in infinite union. And therefore that's why he has a smile on his face. He has a funny little grin on his face. So mainly what I wanted to convey in this talk is these points. So Buddhist understanding of what a Buddha is, and I hope I've tried to convey that by definition. I don't pretend I know that fully yet. I had a few hints, though. And at least I may be just demented. You know, I am a bit demented in my 70s. But I'm certain that it is so. That I know by inference, because it doesn't involve Buddhism, it involves logic. In infinity of space and time, and infinity of continuity, since we've all had beginninglessly alive, and we'll be endlessly alive, in that infinity, then no one can say that one will not come to understand the reality of all of that, of it all. You have endless time. No matter how stupid you are, if you have endless time, and even one body dies, you come in another one. And even you lose human form, you'll come back to it again and again. And so eventually you'll get sick of not understanding where you are and not knowing what and who you are and what your reality is and what everyone else is, and you will come to understand it, I'm certain. I'm certain I'll take a longer time than most of you, I'm sure, because I'm probably more dense. Males in general are more dense, actually. We are dumber. In the sense that the enlightenment is the ability to identify beyond your skin, to identify with other, but also inanimate, not only living others, but objects and planets and stars and galaxies and subatomic energies. So, since that is it, and the female is much more biologically and evolutionarily adapted to expanding her sense of identification than the male is, males are, therefore, they are more enlightened automatically, in spite of what patriarchal society imbued Buddhists over history have said. I think it's, and Buddha reveals it clearly in the Vajrayana, for sure. So anyway, the Buddhist understanding of what is a Buddha, this infinite bliss. The quantum people are almost there. They have something they call the quantum zero-point vacuum field, which has, ironically, it's completely empty, but has infinite energy. The infinite energy is completely quiescent because it's infinite, so it doesn't need to do anything. Everything is done. But any other thing in reality that's non-vacuum can draw infinitely on it without depleting that infinite energy. So they're baffled by that, but that's like the clear light of the void. Although they probably don't think of it as clear light, they think of it as a darkness. You know, the materialist thinks of sort of the ground level of things, when everything has dissolved under analysis, they think they've found nothing. And therefore, that's a darkness. And also, we all may think that because when we fall asleep, when we go out unconscious, it seems like we fall into a darkness, which of course we welcome when we're tired. And we miss the fact that underneath the layer of the darkness is this transparency, translucency, infinite energy beyond the duality of light and dark, clear light of the void. And then where we are is this Buddha emanation body, what's called nirmana, which means to emanate illusorily and magically, body as works of art. It's in the name of Buddha's mother, by the way. Buddha's mother is Maya, Maya Devi, the goddess of magic. You know, not illusion. Illusion is all right, but, you know, an illusionist is a magician, right? So illusion is a little rude to call Buddha's mother illusion. Queen illusion, oh, how are you? No. But Queen magic, she doesn't mind. So therefore, that's the Nirmanakaya. It's spelled out below there. Then there's a wonderful theory in Mahayana, elaborated by Maitreyanatha, the future Buddha, and Asanga, that there are three levels of the emanation body. There's what's called supreme emanation body, which is like a Shakyamuni Buddha type, you know, with all the signs, you know, with the extra scoop of brains, with the long earlobes, with the little tuft of white hair that radiates light on his forehead, etc. All kind of things, with, you know, that a Buddha has. That's called supreme Nirmanakaya, that sets an example of becoming, of seeking enlightenment for a planet full of human beings. Then there is called Janma Nirmanakaya, which means incarnational emanation body, which can be ordinary looking humans of different kinds, or it could be animals, that somehow create a presence, a doorway to the imagination of enlightenment for other beings. And then this one is the artist thing. Shilpa means art. It's making something. Shilpa Nirmanakaya means, and I love this one, and that's why I have, my life's ambition is to make a movie of the life of Buddha, the magical life of Buddha, not the one of him running around in the dust and the sort of modern vision, the materialist vision of Buddha is just another guy running around in the dust, you know, like a Socrates in an underdeveloped country or something. Like, silly, because India was California at those times. It was the richest, most powerful country in Eurasia. And by not at all, and he was the most powerful social class, etc. And it was not at all some poor guy running around in the dust, making no dent. So, but Shilpa Nirmanakaya means that when you artists, when you are completely gone into your work, and bliss, the bliss of inspiration filling you from your toes to the crown of your head, including your earlobes and fingertips, and you are flowing, you're in the flow, and you're not thinking about how much you're going to sell it for or whatever. You're not thinking about how famous you're going to be. You're not thinking about anything you're getting out of it. You're just beside yourself, and it's just coming through you in that state of inspiration. Then you are Shilpa, and therefore you're conveying to the other, the bliss-deprived beings, you're creating a doorway to that bliss. The bliss is expressing itself through you, and it's opening a portal for the observer or the experiencer or the listener or whatever form of art it is. That's what you're doing. Then you are part of the Shilpa Nirmanakaya. You become taken up in the Nirmanakaya of the Buddha. So that is, you become like a sacred entity. But in a way, sacred has a slightly wrong connotation in the sense that it's sort of way above everybody. This is not above. This is like flowing through the cells of everything. It's like right there in the middle of it. Your art piece should be not some exalted thing beyond people. It should be tar baby that they, like a tar baby they get stuck in. And it's a bliss tar baby. And they like take a hold of it. I want to own it. I want to invest in it. I want to get away. I want to know what it is. But then they get stuck on it. Oh, they feel better. Whatever happens, even they lose the auction. Shilpa Nirmanakaya. It's such a beautiful. And that means, see, in my mathematics, my simple-minded thinking, that means if we made a Buddha film, Life of Buddha, then even the gaffers would be part of Shilpa Nirmanakaya when they were really doing their job, making the scene, you know, the makeup artist. Like somebody, maybe the producer wouldn't be because we'd be sitting thinking how much money they'd make. But then they would be motivated the wrong way. But some of the time, when they went out to do it, they'd be well motivated, but after a while they might get lost. But the people working, so the whole crew would be Shilpa Nirmanakaya. It would be like a Nirmanakaya crew. It would be so much fun. Anyway, if anybody tried to make a Buddha movie where they weren't having fun, it would suck. So looking at living with works in this way. First work was Buddha's smile. See, Buddha to smile. See, you know, when Buddha realized his Buddhahood, you know, he gives a clue to it in all of the traditional accounts, including Theravada account. His mind raced through past and future first, completely encompassed infinite past and future. And so, you know, because his super subtle, great bliss heart mind was the mind that did the final realizing. Right? Remember the way they put it is he remembered infinite previous lives. He remembered then infinite previous lives of everybody else. Because, of course, we've been infinitely intertangled with each other. Everybody's been our mother. We've been their mother, actually. Huge job all around. Many times, given infinity. And so he felt all of that. He was completely interwoven with every being that way. Then he saw all the future possible destinies of everyone. And they all came into the moment with him. So his mind was out of his, beyond his body, actually. His body was just one aspect of it. He was like in every other body, in every level, in every universe, every world, even every insect, every kind of being. So coming back into his body was like taking rebirth back into first his super subtle heart center, then in his central nervous system, then into his coarse body and his senses, and then he became aware of beings observing him, whether observing him from future time, through history, through narrative, whether the gods were observing him. Don't ever believe the Buddha ever denied that gods exist. Totally Buddha, totally talked to them. They were his stupid students and disciples. They were stupid, some of them, but his disciples. They get arrogant, the gods do, you know. But they came and studied with him. There's a beautiful Sanskrit poem that says, "May there be good fortune to you from the joy that the gods feel when they see the reflection of their jewel diadems in the Buddha's shining toenails as they bow down to his feet. May this go to you for your joy and good fortune. That's sweet. So then he really wanted to, then everyone in time and space, aware of the Buddha, just attained enlightenment, discovered reality, experienced all of reality, what it is. And now he knows what it is. Like, what is it? What is it, Buddha? You know, he could have done, oh, crap, what a bummer. Ah, right? Could have done like that. Instead, he smiled, like, okay, it's all right. Everything's all right. Encouraged us a lot there, isn't that sweet? Look at that. They're looking in four directions. Stupa means the arrangement of the elements of earth, water, fire, and wind in total balance, in the total presence of the Buddha. What is the Buddha? Okay. I don't know how to go through all this. We have the world totally upside down. We think that relative reality is absolute. We think that we are absolute. Our imagined rigid self-identity is the real us. As my old Lama used to say, everyone is correct that they're real, but no one is correct what they tend to think that they're really real. That's when they get into a problem. Everyone is only unreally real. We're all illusory, which is not a bad thing. It's a good thing. It means that we are works in progress. We can transform ourselves. The result of understanding emptiness is not that, oh, I can space out and nothing exists and, oh, great, and I'm free of it all because it's all not there. That's nihilism. The realization of emptiness is the realization of relativity, that I'm creating the world. You're creating the world. Everyone is creating the world. And so each one is responsible for what they are creating, what they are bringing to it, how they imagine. Our imaginations, well, the world is nothing but the intersection of infinite living beings' imaginations. Therefore, the artist, as Shelley said, is the unacknowledged legislator of mankind, because they're trying to consciously imagine it better, more beautiful, right? So that's a heavy job. It's more important than the president. That's why he gave her the Nobel Peace Prize the other day, Mr. and Mrs. President. That's so great. I can't believe it. We're seeing you like 3 days after you got the Nobel Peace Prize. We're so lucky. Did you know that? You all see that on the internet? Meredith Monk got that. I mean, you know, whatever. The Artist Peace Prize, whatever it is called. The gold medal. Something. Should have been gold. So anyway, this is our problem. We think we are really us. And the world is not us. And of course, that's hopeless. The second truth of the Four Noble Truths is not rocket science. If it's you versus everything else, there's no way to win that. There, but there he says, his left hand is saying, don't be scared. His right hand is saying, you can have whatever you want. He's granting boons. That's a work of art. He shaped his whole body out of cells. He knows that the cells in his body are, he's just as much identifies with the cells and the red land around him, anybody who's looking at him. He's all of them. It's not just that. But he can shape that in such a way as to convey something to people. So Buddha investigated. He found we're in error. It is not us versus the universe. The fixed separate self is an illusion. In reality, we are free of self-identity, of any non-relational absolute core self-essence, immaterial fixed soul, you know, and that we are instead selfless souls, infinite, relative, subtle continua without static identity, which means, you know, and totally interrelated to everything else, and which means that the imperative of emptiness is compassion, because it's actually bliss and compassion. We should always have the step of bliss there, because that's what it is, because it means that we have to be here. You realize, the realization of emptiness is that there is no emptiness apart from this. There is no nirvana apart from this. This is nirvana. So you better make the best of this nirvana. Like people say, oh, no. He didn't tell some of those. You know, the first dualistic Buddhism, which he taught about how, you know, you can all get out of here, was taught to who mainly? Bunch of male chauvinist idiot Brahmins who made their ladies stay in the kitchen cooking and never even come out, wouldn't eat at the table with them. They're sitting back there stoking that fire. They're still in India today. If you ever go and visit a colleague who's a male Brahmin professor somewhere, Mrs. Professor never shows up. Scuttles out and gives you a dish and scuttles away. Traditional people, I mean. So those male Brahmins, they didn't want to live in it, be stuck in a universe forever, where they might eventually have to get into the kitchen themselves. No way. So he said, don't worry, guys. There's nirvana waiting for you up there somewhere. Oh, great, they said. I'm getting out of here. And then luckily what happens when they do that, guided by him, is when they said, well, now and then they stop going, let me get out of here. And they say, well, Buddha, are you sure? Is there a self afterwards? And he would say, I can't say. Well, is there no self? Well, no, I'm not quite saying. He never would say. So what happens is that self-centered self-identity escapes there since it never existed. They just like, oh, they loosen up. They become more cool. They get relaxed, those kind of Brahmins. And then they're ready for being bodhisattvas. That's Moggallana. Aren't they sweet? They just drop out. They're just heading for the outer. There's your Manjushri, that one. Kashmiri. So beautiful. Kashmir things. Exquisite. Little book there. Prajnaparamita book. On his lotus. And that's Mrs. Avalokiteshvara. Kuan Yin. So he realized his own freedom from separate selfhood. He enjoyed the release of his relative self. He realized infinite interconnection with all beings, feeling freedom, bliss to be theirs as much as his, yet not ignoring their error trap of suffering. That was his universal compassion was inevitable. His dharma sambhoga, his reality, beatitude, and emanation bodies still holds us all in a gentle mandala of liberative education. Parinirvana as nirvana. Oh, yeah. Parinirvana, you know, the dualistic Buddhists who think that you're getting away, you see. They still, to this day, they insist that Buddha got out of his body permanently, and they translate parinirvana as final nirvana. But pari doesn't mean final. Pari means thorough. So it simply expresses that when that Buddha leaves behind a particular emanation body, he shows that as being impermanent to people to teach them impermanence, to intensify their use of their precious human life endowed with liberty and an opportunity of intelligence and access to the teaching of enlightened beings from their human form. And he's emphasizing by leaving the body that nirvana is everywhere, like I started this talk saying, because you made me think so. You looked so happy, seriously sitting there meditating away. And the artistic meditation. That's all right, you can snooze, that's good. That's a great compliment, actually, they say. Zen, thank you. Okay, there he is, look at him. He's happy as a bee. They're kind of freaky, look, oh no, Buddha's leaving. But he's totally happy. The East Asian people are much proud of themselves because they show Buddha's parinirvana with animals being present. There's a bunch of, you know, dogs and cats and lions and camels and things around outside the rows of people. You can't see that on this screen. Anybody here doesn't think they're going to have a future life? Anybody dares? Huh? Anybody thinks they're nothing? You swallow that crap from our unsensuous, scientistic worldview that we grew up in high school and everything, where you're assured. I'm just, for once and for all, I want to finish it all for you. Anybody, even you might not think that, but we all sort of feel still it's only this life, you know, because we're brought up like that in our school system. But who, and you know, when you talk to somebody who's like a big, like, I'm brave, I face my existential nothingness. I can take it. And they look really uptight, and they're like, I can. You people are just childish. You want to just be there forever going to the mall, you know. And then they say, you think there's a future life? What's your evidence? And then you say, well, there's a lot of evidence, doctor, professor. There's a lot of people remember previous lives. Then not only that, there's the idea of everything in nature has a continuity. Why should consciousness be the one thing that doesn't have a continuity? You look a little thoughtful at that. But a lot of people remember previous lives. Very commonly documented. It's all anecdotal. Then you say, excuse me, I believe that they just electrocuted a bunch of people on anecdotal evidence in Texas and Arkansas and all over the place. Gave them lethal injection based on anecdotal evidence. Don't say it has no power. It's inadmissible. Or there have been a lot of injustice, and there has been. But anecdotal is powerful. Well, you know. But then they are feeling still immune from the facing continuity, their own continuity. And then they simply say this. What's your evidence that you can be nothing? Could you please tell me? Did Carl Sagan report back? Hey guys, I'm cool. I'm nothing. I don't exist. Could he ever report back if he's nothing? Has anyone ever found nothing? Ever? Could anyone ever find nothing? Of course not. Therefore, that belief that you can be nothing is the original blind faith belief. It's much more reasonable to think maybe there's a God out there tinkering around like some Steve Jobs in the sky, like making like a big planetary iPhone or something. That could be. You know, at least it's something going on. Nothing? I believe in nothing? That is an expression of complete psychotic insanity. So our whole authority system of the high MIT and the whole thing, Columbia University, natural sciences, nature. We know nature. And we know that there's nothing. And you don't have a mind. Your mind is, actually, you have continuity. Because before you were born, your mind was nothing. While you're alive, your mind is nothing. After you die, it's going to be nothing again. It's just temporarily your brain makes you think you got something going. But that's registering on nothing. So you are nothing to start with. So therefore, if anything bad happens, just shoot yourself. That's the ridiculous, blind faith, irrational, and psychotic level of authority that runs this planet, and that's why it's running this planet into the ground, or rather, through the ground, into the lava. I can't bear it that people think that Buddha didn't think there was former and future life. It doesn't have to be a Buddha. You just have to be mildly rational. Scientists have to look at the law of thermodynamics, that there's no energy can ever be created from nothing, cannot become nothing. Even the vacuum mathematically has infinite energy. So, how can you tell someone without just completely deceiving them that they are going to be nothing? You cannot. How can you tell yourself you're going to be nothing? You're going to be rudely awakened. Carl Sagan, he was like freaked out. But you know, he liked the Dalai Lama. He met the Dalai Lama. He asked the Dalai Lama once, he said, Your Holiness, it's on video. Has anybody ever seen? He says, Your Holiness, what would you do if we set up a foolproof, perfect experiment and prove beyond a shadow of a doubt there was no reincarnation? Dalai Lama thinks for a minute and says, I'd cease to believe in it. Well, I would just disagree with that idea that there was such a thing. If you proved it like that, I'd accept that. Dalai Lama said, Sagan's jaw hit the floor. While he was scooping it back up, there's one, two, three beats on the tape. Then Dalai Lama says, okay, how are we going to set up that experiment? Silence. Silence. I think that on his deathbed, at his post-death moment, Sagan remembered that conversation. I think. So that means you've always been here, everyone. You have an infinite. You've been everything already. You don't have to be impressed. You don't have to freak out when some anthropologist out in Africa or in some lab somewhere in Southern California or something, like they do a tweak or something, or some chimpanzee types something on a computer or whatever they do. Oh, they think. Oh, they feel something. Oh, they're like us. You could just write them a telegram. Listen, I was a chimpanzee. And I was the chimpanzee who wanted to have less facial hair and like a little more opposable thumb and nicer fingernails and something. And so I decided I wanted to be a human. And that chimp that you're talking to is going to be your grandson. You know, just don't be so mystified, you know. Something like that. You know, Buddhahood is the goal. Therefore, Buddhahood is an evolutionary goal because everyone wants infinite bliss. And everyone wants to be an infinite being. And they don't even know if for sure if they can. And they have to meet one, they say. And you have. We've all met Buddhas. We didn't necessarily recognize, but even the perfect Buddha, what they call Supreme Emanation Body Buddha, we've met in literature, in chanting, in history, and sutras. You meet, you can feel that personality. You feel it. That guy, he has a hell of a sense of humor. You can see it. He's there. We've all met Buddhists. You have to meet one to realize something. Well, Dalai Lama is close enough. Someone who's different. Someone who's not just there inside their skin. Someone who's with you, enfolds you in being with you completely in a relaxed manner, accepts the way you are, actually, and sees how you're seeing, and it takes your has other concern rather than just thinking how they are positioned and where they what they're doing in the scene, you know. Everyone has met people like that, but he's like a particularly huge example. That's why people love to see him so much. Okay, and there I just put this here because this is one of those marvelous Tibetan mandalas. But this is taking us in the direction, like the Flower Ornament Sutra of the Buddhist. Not only is there a Buddhist relativity vision and a Buddhist infinite energy of the vacuum, voidness, clear light of bliss, discovery, scientific reality discovery, not some God didn't say, oh, that's how it is, you have to believe it and no for no reason. No, he discovered the nature of reality that way and he's reported back on it like a scientist. And he discovered that there's like every atom has mandalas and worlds and universes and Buddhas in it. And there is actually, he discovered there is no indivisible atom, actually. Atom itself is a construct, something imagined, actually, by the minds of the beings, not just human beings, all beings. Anyway, it's a beautiful thing. It's a mandala, you know. These are sort of archetypes of how to create a platform of bliss from within which to expand the access to bliss of infinite numbers of beings. It's a cultivate the vision like that. And it's like Jung's idea thing about the mandala, except that they did it for so and so many centuries and so many adepts, saw so many different kinds that they have a huge archive of them, basically. Whereas Jung was having some people in Zurich do some and was beginning to develop one, but you know, just beginning to. This is like a huge, and the Indians did, this is a Tibetan one, and sadly, because of the Islamic fear of the anthropomorphic form and of, you know, of idolatry, they're overdoing the idolatry injunction, and a misunderstanding of it actually, because it's actually quite a sensible thing, but by doing that, they then went and they eradicated all Buddhist painting in India practically. Which was an enormous archive of painting, much bigger even than the Tibetans did in their 13 centuries of it, 15 centuries of Buddhist art. Buddha awakens. We already told you enough of this stuff. I think you got all of that. Nirvana just means blown away. It does. That's this cool thing. Hipster language nowadays fits so well with the Dharma. For example, morality, Shila, Shila, which people translate as morality, but Shila comes from a word, from a root in Sanskrit, which means to be cool. So when you're ethical, things are cool, because you don't irritate people, and things are cool. So your life becomes more cool. You're more cool by being ethical. You're uncool by being unethical. And when you have like, when you feel the bliss as an artist, when you encounter the bliss through the work of art of another, you're blown away. That's Buddha and Bodh Gaya, Shakyamuni and Bodh Gaya, which is considered a pure land, you know, or it's the heart of this whole world, which is Shakyamuni's pure land nowadays. They say, anyway, that's just some fun. We did everything. Oh yeah, that's my favorite phrase, His Holiness's favorite phrase, Nagarjuna's favorite phrase. If you remember any phrase from this evening, Shunyata Karuna Garbham. It's so beautiful. In Tibetan, it's even more beautiful because of the sound, the alliteration in Tibetan. Dong Nid Ning Je Ning Bo Jen. Tenzila. Dong Nid Ning Je Ning Bo Jen. Ning Ning Ning. Dong Nid Ning Je Ning Bo Jen. The word for heart in Tibetan is Ning. And Dong Ni is not Ning, but it's Ni. Dong Ni means emptiness. Ning Je means heart, heart mastering, which means compassion. And Ningbo Jen, Ningbo means essence. So it's Ning Ning Ning. Dong Ni Ning Je Ningbo Jen. Shunyata Karuna Garbham. Garbham means a womb. You know, when they say Buddha nature, people go around going, oh, my Buddha nature. But it means a womb, actually. So males might not run around and say, I have a Buddha nature. Because it actually means a womb, Garbha. And so emptiness, the womb of compassion. So here you have a vision of emptiness, not as like a null state, like a blank darkness, but as a membrane, a delicate nurturing membrane that nurtures what is within it, like a womb, creatively. That's what emptiness is. It is this infinitely, a membrane that covers every kind of inconceivable subatomic micro macro service of the universe. Shunyata, the emptiness, voidness, I prefer voidness. Voidness, the womb of compassion. And it's the womb of compassion because when people's absolute seeking sort of ultimate life and death intensity and concern that is often focused on us suffering beings, we focus it on how to escape from everything, get away from it all. And when that collides with reality and escapes from it all and it's all here still, although more a little bit easier to take, because like in a dream or like an illusion, not a total illusion or a total dream, real, but like a dream and an illusion, then that absolute seeking, absolute energy goes into love and compassion. It's the only place it goes. If this is the absolute nirvana, then this has to be absolutely better. That's why the beautiful phrase in the Samadhi Raja Sutra, who understands causality, understands emptiness, will understand or understands emptiness. Who understands emptiness becomes mindful of the most minute things and fully aware of them. Emanations radiate the presence of the underlying reality of bliss, void, indivisible. Suffering is as being trapped in illusion. Victim must be able to imagine relief of freedom to be motivated to seek it. So therefore, all art, I should never mind Buddhist, especially Buddhist, but all art thus evokes such imagination. Therefore, first work of Buddhist art with Buddhist smile. Okay, be good night. Thank you.
I'm Gary Gawk, and this segment is a part of the Bob Thurman Podcast and is published by Tibet House U.S., Menla Retreat, and Dewa Spa under a Creative Commons attribution, non-commercial, no derivatives license. Please feel free to share, redistribute, and post via your favorite online portal. Tashi Delos.